Good morning. I was struck this weekend about how much there is to do, about how many how much goings-ons there are, and especially, you know, having to write a talk, it's when do I sit down? And then once I've sat down, it's like, how do I choose among all of the teeming events, moments that comprise our life to talk about? And so once again, we realize writing a talk is, it's a process which forces one to land. And I think I got from this time, maybe, Joshin, you have an issue with landing. So this thing is still in process, and I'm hoping that together we can sort through what it means to land and whether we should. There's the exchange Master Zwiegen would have with himself, Master Zwiegen Shigen. He used to call out to himself and say, "Oh, Master," and would answer himself, "Yes." And then, "Are you awake?" he would ask, and then again would answer, "Yes, I am." And then, "Never be deceived by others, any time, any day." "No, I will not." And so the commentary on this koan says that Master Zwiegen is buying and selling himself, taking off one mask and putting on another. See, so then it raises the question, then, so where do I find myself? How do I say this is where I am? So there's a story about a Chinese carpenter that I came upon in the process of writing this talk. And his work, this carpenter's work, was so extraordinary that Prince Lu called him in and said, he said, "These things you make are so perfect that it doesn't seem possible that any human being could make them. Is it true or is it not true that in your work you have superhuman assistance?" And Ching, the carpenter, who was a very humble man, answered the Prince of Lu something like this. He said, "Well, first of all, when I am to make some cabinet or box of great quality, I separate myself from the world for 2 days." So clearly we're talking pre-technology, pre-industrial, pre-capitalist society. "And at the end of that time, I'm no longer aware of title, dignity, or estate, so that no matter for whom I'm making this box, I'm making it simply for a person. There's no longer any glamour, no sense that I would make a better box for a nobleman. Then for 2 days more, I relax and meditate." And I come to the conclusion that it's of no consequence whether the box is good or bad. I no longer fear that my work will not be sufficient. I no longer hope that it will be outstanding. I've lost all interest in whether I'm praised or blamed for the thing I've produced. Then, in 2 days more, I'm no longer aware of myself. I no longer care whether I exist or not. Gradually, that part of my mind that is naturally and usually devoted to personal concerns is relaxed away from these so that I no longer know that I have a body or that I have hands and feet. Everything becomes quiet. And all this time, I've been visualizing what I'm going to build until finally there's nothing but visualization and the object. I then go out into the forest or wherever the materials for the object are to be found, and I wander about until I find my piece of work somewhere within the body of something that already exists. I look at a tree and say, there's my box. I look at a bamboo and say, there's my screen. I am aware that I'm going to move the box that is already there in the tree to where it can be seen. Then I sit down quietly with all my materials and I allow heaven to put the box together. When heaven puts the box together, the seams are perfect. When men put a box together, the seams are not perfect because a man will say, this seam is better than that seam, or I must make a good seam, or will the purchaser be pleased with the box? Thus, all things come to nothing. But I am concerned only with the fact that heaven makes a box. And the box that heaven makes will please heaven. And if I'm fortunate in all these matters, the box I make will cause the Prince of Lu to say to me, did you receive superhuman help? So, from this story, I got that to give a talk, I had to get out of my own way. You know, allow the part that's concerned about what impression I'll make to quiet down and allow somehow the subject itself to suggest itself and to find my materials within my immediate environment. Only problem was I didn't have 6 days to set aside to do this. But, you know, we see how in Zazen, isn't that also what we're doing? That sense of sitting down, taking our cushion, taking our seat, and settling. And all the various parts of ourselves, all the various voices that come out to play, to drop them. And at that point, we're told there's only heaven. The no self. The no self that is comprised simply of the sound of this drone, the twinge in your knee, the question, what is she talking about? Would she ever get to the point? So this no self that gets a lot of air in Zen We understand it to mean dropping the ego, and at the very least becoming aware that it's not in the driver's seat. And so I want to see with Master Zwigan, you see, whether we can actually separate out these selves. The self that's worried about what impression it's making, the self that's afraid it's not up to the job, the self that is filled with its concerns about whatever. And that whether in our attempt to drop these parts of ourselves out, we might be throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Which is another way of saying that our desire, my desire to act from no self, is just another number I play on myself. One way of doing this is discounting my own experience in the moment, as if it were somehow not good enough. Something else would be better, some ideal experience, like the carpenters. Better way of feeling. Here's an example. Have you ever gone to a movie and with some friends, and you're very moved by the movie? You're moved to tears. And you're sniffling at the end, and people are filing out. You turn to find out how your friends, what they thought of the movie. Friends kind of go, huh, left me cold. Dumb movie, and you feel, oh my God, here I am. I'm so completely racked emotionally by that movie. Was it that I was manipulated by the director and my friends are cleverer than me? They didn't allow themselves to be pulled. Or the opposite. They have this phenomenal, they relate to this movie, and you feel, I didn't get it, frankly. And so there's this connect. What's wrong with me? Why am I experiencing something they're not? And that can be lonely. Can't it? I mean, in a way, we kind of choose our friends because we feel they're sympathetic to our way of being in the world. Chances are more that you'll respond the same way to things. And you see that, don't you, in the elections, the conversations that you come upon, and what a shock it is to find colleagues you work with, or even Sangha members you sit with who are rooting for a different person. And you kind of quietly walk away and say, all right, I don't want to be part of that echo chamber. And yet, I've also learned through experience that it's the relationships where you've never had an argument that we need to worry about. Where the differences haven't surfaced, or somehow we've each managed to very subtly avoid airing any differences. Because then we realize that it's It's not the differences, you see, that are the problem, but it's our inability to weather them, to air them, to work with them. And I find this can come up in a meeting. You know, someone runs an idea, airs an idea that you're not particularly enthusiastic about, but the whole group seems to be going with it. And so you might feebly say, but nobody picks up on your reservation, and so the group decides to go with this plan. And then a little further down the road, you see, actually, this plan is not, doesn't have any steam behind it. And it turns out that maybe there are other people who also had reservations, but they kind of didn't want to be disagreeable. And so it happens over and over again, not just at the Village Zendo, but corporations, organizations will go down a certain road only to find that 85% of the people or something weren't behind this idea, but didn't have the guts. They didn't feel comfortable in expressing themselves because it would have gone counter to the prevailing, what they consider to be the prevailing notion. And so what this points to is the courage it takes to show up actually with, for what's happening in oneself, to the little voice that says, nah, don't think so. Even though that may be uncomfortable, you see, and even though there may be part of us that says, shh, shh, go away. You're not pretty enough, nice enough, pleasant enough, agreeable enough. You are inconvenient. Now, you've all heard of Hannah Arendt, who covered the Eichmann trials in Nuremberg in the 60s.
It was in Jerusalem.
And this was the trial for Eichmann, the SS officer who had overseen the murder of millions of Jews. And as he stood on trial and the questions were asked, how could you have said yes? How could you have participated in these atrocities? Day after day, month after month. And what she pointed to was the fact that this man was not a monster. He was actually very, very normal. She called it banal. His responses were banal in the sense of he just said, well, I was following orders. And she pointed to the fact that this man seemed incapable of thinking for himself. And she said, to think for oneself is always dangerous. To question orders, to allow oneself to have a different thought, to actually listen to the part of oneself that is having a reaction which says, something about this is making me uncomfortable. And I'm going to listen to that rather than go with what's more comfortable. So it means to be able to engage in conflict, to raise differences, to, it requires, if you will, the ability to be alone, to not have the comfort of your boss's, your leader's approval, your group, your cohorts. Neurobiology shows that from the get-go, an infant's emotional circuitry develops by dint of the mother's attunement to the child. So the child learns by dint of the mother's support. Oh, honey has a colic. Oh, let me hold you. That hurts. So that way the child learns to be able to tolerate its own experience by being held by this soothing, calming figure. Now, in the event that the roles get reversed, as happens, where the mother herself is whatever, depressed, anxious, and in need of soothing, calming, she may require the infant to do that for her, in which case the infant learns to downplay its own experience, and it loses that capacity. Its only way to metabolize this experience is to cut it off, disown it. And to develop into what's known as an as-if personality, which is, I will be what you need me to be for you. There's someone I work with who has, in her mid-50s, reached the top of her professional ladder, all the rewards of reputation, status, very highly regarded. Besides being very competent, she's a very kind person, and so all of the junior colleagues constantly ask her for help with their projects, which she agrees to do, and then, of course, ends up having endless deadlines to meet. Very high standards, has to do things better than others. And yet, even with all of this work and these accolades, her heart is not in what she does, what she's not connected. She says that actually her chosen field leaves her feeling empty and hollow. As a young child, she was sent away to boarding school, and her older sister had gone before her and did very, very well, and she followed in her footsteps and did what she could to get top grades, top marks, and learn how to do that. And became very, very, very good, getting first prize, first place. Now she says that she feels like she's a marionette who's been wound up and marches to the beat of others. And only now is she learning in her 50s to not take her mother's call at 2 a.m. in the morning, calling from this other country. The mother needs her to calm her. She has a problem. And never occurred to her not to take her mother's call. She's learning in her mid-50s to say, no, Mom, I have my needs. So many of us may have come into practice entranced with the idea, you see, of transcending this messy, incomplete sense of feeling deficient and inadequate, and sensing that somehow, if I experience no self that they talk about, that will all magically go away. And I will be released from my small-mindedness, my reactivity, my pettiness. And yet we see, just like the baby whose colicky wails can only be soothed by someone tender and loving and holding, that the only way we can taste that sense of, as we see, the oneness of no self, is to meet our own experience with that same sense of tenderness, curiosity, and respect. For to do otherwise is to cheat ourselves, to deceive ourselves. If we can't show up for ourselves in each moment, just as we are, dirty diapers included, who will? Here's how the poet M.W.S. Merwin puts it. Too waiting. You spend so much of your time expecting to become someone else, always someone who will be different, someone to whom a moment, whatever moment it may be, at last has come and who has been met and transformed into no longer being you, and so has forgotten you. Meanwhile, in your life, you hardly notice the world around you. Lights changing, sirens dying along the buildings, your eyes intent on a sight you do not see yet, not yet there, as long as you are only yourself, with whom, as you recall, you were never happy to be left alone for long. So, that's what I'm working on landing where I am. Thank you for your support in that.